Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So today the government is announcing emergency legislation to tackle the problem of automatic release for jihadis from prison after the Streatham attack on the weekend. Katie, can you tell us what they are suggesting to do?
So on Monday in the chamber, Robert Buckland laid out some of the measures that they plan to unveil. What the emergencies legislation is aimed at is changing it. So at the moment, if you're a convicted terrorist, if you serve half your sentence, you can be up for automatic release. They'll be changing that to two thirds. And at two thirds, it doesn't happen automatically. It goes to the parole board. Now, what's slightly controversial about this legislation is it's not just to apply to people who are convicted from this point forwards. The idea is that it would apply retrospectively. This is why the government are braced for a legal challenge on it. And I think there is some debate as there are figures in government who would say it's not retrospective because you're not actually changing the length of the sentence. Someone will still have been sentenced for an amount of time. It's just you're changing what percentage of that sentence they serve. But clearly you've heard from human rights campaigners, civil liberties campaigners, that they object to this. So I think we can expect it to potentially end up in the courts. I also think it's worth noting on this that this isn't really a change in tack from what Boris Johnson government have been saying for some time. Mm. After the London Bridge attack, you had a situation where Boris Johnson went on to the Andrew Marr show and basically tried to outline some of these measures that they would want to put in place. And it included these things, so ending automatic release. But I think after the Streatham attack, there is a sense of urgency. So the government is saying it's exceptional measures for exceptional times. And we are happy to go to court about this if we have to, because we believe we are on the right side.
I think what is clear about the case of a Streatham attacker is he was released from prison despite the fact that kind of everyone right across the system agreeing that he was a danger to the public. But that's the point, is that this is not someone who managed to persuade people that he had been de-radicalised, that he had changed his ways. Everyone, and that's why there was, you know, days after his release, a team of 20 people following him around under very close surveillance, which is why they could move so quickly. And I mean, that is the problem that's got to be addressed. I think there is a massive public policy issue here, which is, you know, to speak in crude terms, Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism was about big spectacular. So you blow up the Houses of Parliament or Big Ben or Buckingham Palace. And that meant that even when people became radicalised, you had quite a lot of time to stop them, because that kind of attack takes planning. You have to get in contact with other people and you can then charge them with a fairly serious offence. The issue with ISIS-inspired terrorism is the ISIS mindset is basically, if you can kill a few people, do it. Even if that ends up in your own death, whether it be one person or two person, just take that opportunity. And that is very hard to combat, because as soon as people have got that idea in their head, they are dangerous. So you're having to bring them in early for what seem like relatively minor offences, like sharing terrorist propaganda or things like that. And I think the other danger is, you know, with Al-Qaeda suspects, there was an argument that very close monitoring would work, was, you know, you restricted their access to the internet, you followed them to see who they were meeting. You know, I think what the Streatham attacker showed on Sunday is that with someone like with this mindset, even very close surveillance is not enough to protect the public. This man still managed to attack two people, despite the presence of this, as we clearly can see from the fact he was shot within moments of starting the attack, despite the presence of armed police officers so close to him. And I think this is the challenge. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with people who are convicted of relatively minor offences, who then come up for release, but are clearly still dangerous? I mean, what is the way you tackle that problem? I think that is a very, very hard problem to work out.
Katie, answer the problem. What do you think is the way to do it? I mean,
well, I think on a long-term level, clearly one of the issues we have is our current prison system. And there's some saying people should be released, but the point is lots of these people, such as it seems in this case, are radicalised within prison. We've heard previous times our prison system is not fit for purpose. We need more prisons. We need prisons with better facilities. Lots of the buildings are pretty run down. So it's much harder to control the situation within them. So I think that once you're looking at, once you move beyond immediate risk, so what the government's legislation is aimed at is the fact that lots of convicted terrorists are coming up for release under this current plan. So you could have a situation where you have 20 police surveilling various suspects, and perhaps it's just a matter of time. So it's trying to deal with that. I think once you have done that, you get to the second stage of it, which is long term, are you saying these convicted terrorists can be rehabilitated, and if so, how? And what's the best route to doing that? Because I don't think anyone really would say, you know, even government ministers, that what is currently happening in these prisoners is anywhere close to that goal being achieved. I also think that Boris Johnson's general rhetoric is that he isn't sure rehabilitation is possible in all these cases. But you do need to have a system which has a strategy then. And I think in some cases, rehabilitation may be possible. But what is the general strategy the government is undertaking? Because at the moment, I think, again, and one of the interesting things of this government is because Boris Johnson hasn't been prime minister for very long, often when you have people figures being released, it comes to, well, that was a Labour decision because of a Labour policy change. Theresa May didn't do enough on this. It's like, well, you have a majority of 80. It's your chance to take control of this as an issue. So I think you need to have a more joined up approach.
I think the other challenge is, Katie rightly had the first point about rehabilitation. There is a massive difference between rehabilitating someone who is in prison for stealing a car, for example, than rehabilitating someone who is in prison for having inculcated an entire worldview that leads them to hate the society that they currently live in and wish for its violent overthrow. Some people say Denmark has done it. I think it is very hard to find international examples of where big de-radicalisation programmes have been successful. This is a very hard problem. And because of the changing nature of a terrorist threat, this is something we are going to have to sit down and think about as a society. You know, how do we work? How do we both keep the streets safe and maintain the rule of law when what we're really worried about is what is in people's heads and what that will make them do, rather than just wait? You know, and that I think is what is so difficult, because it can very quickly all become a bit pre-crime if you're not careful. But there is also a problem, which is these people, once they have these ideas in their heads, they are clearly dangerous to be walking down the street, because this isn't dangerous and you should arrest them when they go to the garden centre and, despite only having a window box, buy 12 bags of fertiliser. That, I think, is the crux of the problem, and a problem I have not yet seen a kind of proper answer to.
And the government's got other things on its mind as well. It's recently sacked head of COP26, an upcoming climate change conference in Glasgow. Today hit out on the Today programme. Here's what Claire Perry O'Neill had to say.
What we need to do with this COP is absolutely double down on taking our great leadership and ambitions in this space and really energising the world as to why this is a huge opportunity. And to date, you know, that's been quite a lonely place to come. I mean, the Prime Minister has made incredibly warm statements about this over the years. He's also admitted to me that he doesn't really understand it. And, you know, it's good that...
Really? He said that to you, did he?
You know, yes. I mean, he's had all sorts of things over the years. You know, this is, as I think I said in my letter, you know, this...
He said he doesn't understand climate change.
Well, he doesn't really get it, I think is what he said, but others around him do. And
Katie, you broke the story of her sacking. Can you tell us the background of this? What happened?
Well, I think that if you look at Claire Perry O'Neill's comments since leaving, she's suggesting that she's had various reasons given to her for her dismissal. It happened in a conversation between Dominic Cummings and Claire on the Friday afternoon. I think it's safe to say that the preparations for COP26, which is the UN climate change conference that the UK is hosting this November, were not going completely smoothly. I think there was also a desire to almost... got the word align in my mind from the Brexit coverage yesterday. They wanted to align it with other government departments and make it more joined up. So it's coming under BEIS as the department, and I think they wanted it to be a ministerial appointment rather than an outside appointment. Perry is a former minister, but she was no longer a serving minister. So I think there's a sense it makes more sense to have someone who is, you know, a minister in this current government leading the charge, and that will make it a more joined up approach. But There's lots of potential issues in terms of perhaps this person's manner, along with other things when it came to disagreements. I mean, one thing she's been talking about today is whether it's actually going to take place in Glasgow, how it's been very difficult to get the Scottish government to work with the UK government and to Boris Johnson on this. So she's clearly not at all happy at being let go. And I think that if you think that today was a launch event for COP26 and you had Boris Johnson there with David Attenborough, I think the fact that Claire Perry chose to go on this day programme and give an interview, which is very critical of Boris Johnson, suggests he couldn't really be trusted, and also that he lacked a grasp of the main issue, climate change, is to cause maximum damage. So it's clearly not a parting on good terms. I think going forward, what does it mean for this conference? Well, we still have to find out which minister is going to be in charge of this. It's coming under Bayes, but we are also expecting a reshuffle next week. So I don't think it would be safe to presume it's Andrea Leadsom. I think that's one to watch there. And I think, again, this is, in theory, a very good opportunity for the UK government, despite the fact most of the coverage so far has been quite negative, because the last conference left loads of questions unanswered. So I think if the UK can should take on a leadership role post-Brexit on what the global effort on climate change should be, that is a very positive platform for the UK government to do. And also, I think that what is badly needed is almost this third way on climate change policy and rhetoric, because we have Greta Thunberg, who gets lots of praise on Twitter, Extinction Rebellion, who, again, also quite a lot of praise on Twitter, but I don't think that the public wholesale would be willing to sign up to a lot of things that they are actually suggesting. So almost the rhetoric on climate change activism is quite far apart from where the public is and measures they want to take. So I think that if you look at Boris Johnson's electoral coalition and how he has managed to defy some of the global trends, he is in a position where potentially you can take a stance where you bring people with you. But that said, they will need to probably start to get headlines which are about their plans rather than the fact they don't get on with the departing president.
And James, something else that is on the government's mind today is these two Scottish independence polls that have come out. One of them finds that there's a 52% support for Scottish independence, and another finds yes to be on 50% of the vote. And that's coming after last week's poll showing a lead for independence as well. Is the tide changing for independence?
This is clearly a moment of considerable danger for the union. You know, it appears that the fact that the UK has now left the EU has tipped the numbers in favour of Scottish independence kind of over the 50% mark. Now, I mean, there are a couple of things to say here. The first is that while as Brexit in the abstract might have increased support for Scottish independence, there is an interesting question about whether that support would be maintained when voters in Scotland realise that because the SNP are committed to going back into the EU, there would have to be a goods border between Scotland and the rest of the UK. And the rest of the UK is by far Scotland's largest trading partner. So there would be, you know, to use the term of art, there would be friction in the economic relationship between Scotland and the rest of the UK. And it would be, you know, and given how the SNP are keen to claim that there will be huge numbers of job losses in Scotland because Brexit will put friction into the trading relationship between Scotland and the EU, then presumably they would accept that there would be job losses because independence is going to put friction into the trading relationship between Scotland and the rest of the UK. So that is point one. But I think the second point is the UK government needs to make a better case for the union. I think what the 2014 referendum demonstrated painfully was the 2014 referendum was so negative about the case it made. It needs to make a better case, and it needs to show voters in Scotland what the real benefits are from the union. And I think it also needs to be proud about the union. I thought 2014, the Scottish independence campaign was almost afraid of the word Britishness and what it meant. And I think there is an issue here with COP26 kind of plays into this, which is, you know, why, you know, Claire Perry O'Neill was complaining this morning how the Scottish government had booked all sorts of hotels and venues nearby and that was causing problems. You know, you do wonder, it was incredibly naive if Whitehall thought that the Scottish government would play nice when this conference was held in Glasgow and wouldn't try and take their share of the limelight and the credit. The UK government has got to get a lot smarter about that stuff. And I also think they've got to start doing things to promote I think one of the things that was successfully done by the Canadian government in Quebec was they promoted, you know, other identities within Quebec, whether they be, you know, Montreal, for example. You know. So I think there should be more direct relations, for example, between the UK government and the city government in Glasgow, for example. So I think there are a series of things that need to be done. But, you know, this is something that needs attention because, as Katie has said repeatedly, whatever the government says right now about not granting a Scottish independence referendum, if the SNP win a majority at the Holyrood elections in 2021, it will be very hard to, and Brexit will have happened, you know, Brexit has happened, it is very hard to see what the intellectual justification is in that circumstance for continuing to say no to a Scottish independence referendum at any point in the term of that parliament.
We had an interesting lobby briefing today from John Curtis, the polling guru, and one of the interesting things he was saying on independence was when Brexit first, the result first came through, people thought this could be very difficult for the unionist argument. It's actually been a very slow build to get to the point where in the polls it is now suggesting that independence slightly edges it, but he said it's also now a consistent trend. But I think one of the interesting is how does the UK government tackle this, and what's Boris Johnson's plans? Because a lot of the time you'll hear when you speak to various Tory politicians that they see one of the key things to keeping Scotland on side is in these Brexit negotiations, making sure that fishing rights, you know, they get them back, you don't have the same level of access they currently do. But what John Curtis was saying today was that if you look at the former, you know, unionist voters who voted to stay in the union in the last independence referendum, who are now saying they would vote for independence, it is pretty much wholesale people who support the EU and voted Remain who are now annoyed that the UK has left the EU and they are switching for independence. So if you're going to make an argument to leave people for the union, I think that it's hard to make it too focused on anything you're getting from Brexit. Perhaps there is a way to do it, but it's you're trying to basically say to people who are unhappy with the fact Brexit is happening that they should stick with the UK regardless. And I think that's something which probably needs to come out more in what the government's doing to pitch to those people.
And I suspect we'll hear more about that as well. Boris Johnson's announced that he's going to love bomb Scotland with a £5 million advertising campaign. James and Katie, thanks very much. And you can subscribe, rate and review us through all the usual routes. And you might have seen that we are looking for a podcast producer. So if you'd like to come work with me, James or Katie, or not all of us, but just...
You don't get to pick and choose who you work
with. Yeah, you actually have to work with all of us.
Yeah.
And that's going to get one of us fired.
What do you mean? Oh, well, I'm not hinting that you're going to get fired. No, I don't know anything.
That's not a denial.
It was not, yeah. Anyway, so if you'd like to come work with all of us, you can go to spectator.co.uk/podcast job to find out more about how to apply, and applications close at the end of the month, so do get them in. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.